Our Your Vote 2018 coverage continues. Today, legislative races and gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody. For 2 weeks, Maine Calling is focusing on the upcoming general election. On today's program, we will discuss the state legislature races with Maine Public Political reporters Mal Leary and Steve Missler. And then we'll hear from Republican gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody. Maine Calling is next. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. My guests this half hour are Mal Leary and Steve Missler, two veteran political reporters who will share their perspective on the upcoming election in terms of the state legislature. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email, please make it brief, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Jen.
Happy to be here.
So, Steve and Mal, when you look at the legislative races, the big picture, what are you watching?
Well, I think the big thing, Jennifer, is that the step back and just look at how much pressure is being put on parties to reshape the dynamic that currently exists here. Right now, we have split power between Democrats in the House and Republicans who have a slim majority in the Senate. And everybody is sort of looking forward to reshaping that dynamic in a way that for Democrats, it would, if they were able to get control of the legislature, they would be able to push policies. And if they can get a supermajority, they could, if they happen to have a Republican governor and Sean Moody, they would be able to push their agenda and basically ignore his. And so that's what it all boils down to. And there's some bigger issues, too, which is redistricting. Congressional redistricting is coming up in 2020. And Maine is one of 34 states where the legislature draws the map. And so that is what's also hovering over this, and that's also what's helping, or what's why there's so much outside money coming into these legislative contests.
And Jen, you have to look at where we are right now. The legislature is very equally divided, if you will. Republicans control the Senate 18-17, one vote. Somebody's sick, it's a tie vote. In the House, there is no majority party at the moment. The Democrats lost that majority over the course of the year. They have the plurality of the House, so they didn't lose control of the House because independents in the House vote with them. But the reality is that's a very, very close margin. So we're starting it with this election all new. We're looking at a new governor, and so we have these candidates out there in both the House and Senate that are all trying to figure out, how do I get elected in this constantly changing political landscape?
Steve, well, there's been a lot of national reporting on how many women candidates are running for offices, from everything from mayor to governor to Congress across the country. Are we seeing that in the state legislative races? Are we seeing a lot of women running in Maine this year?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there are 137 women running in the legislature this year, which is the most we've ever seen. The previous record was set 12 years ago when there were 116 women nominees. So we're seeing a big spike in women candidates, not just with Democrats, which is where everybody sort of places the momentum for having women candidates being recruited and run. I mean, in Maine, we have an organization that has been doing, it's called Emerge Maine, that's been doing that recruitment effort for Democrats for a long time. So Maine is a little bit ahead of the game in terms of recruiting women candidates. But the women, Republican women, are also running. There's 12 Republican women running in the state Senate, and that is also a record. And we could have potentially, if Amy Volk, who is a state senator now in Scarborough, if she's able to win re-election, and if she seeks to become the Senate president, she would be the fourth woman president in the history of that body, in the 200-year history of that body, excuse me. So there's a lot of history being made and some potential for history being made after the election in terms of who gets in and who doesn't, especially in the Senate.
And in many ways, Jennifer, this is a continuation of the number of women participating in Maine state government. It's always been higher than in many other states. At one point, I remember when half of the legislative leadership were women. We had a Senate president who was a woman and a Speaker of the House at the same time, the two top positions. So there's an ongoing message here that has just been enlarged this year in terms of the number of women seeking office.
Al, how many people are trying to move from the state house to the state senate?
I don't have an exact count on that, but there are several. This is where term limits kind of falls down. You have a number of people. Let's look at a couple prominent Republicans, Representative Espling, Representative Timberlake, who are in the House. One's in leadership. One was on the Appropriations Committee. They're both seeking to move up to the Senate because they're term limited in the House. There's also kind of the revolving door where we have people who have served as a senator in the past running as a representative, or people who have served as a representative in the past now running as a, for the Senate. So the term limits does keep folks to just four terms, but then it allows them to seek office in the other body. So we're seeing a lot of that going on, a lot of familiar faces on the ballot in various parts of the state.
As far as fundraising, it seems that there are a few high-profile districts, a few that are really getting a lot more money poured into them than in years past. Tell me about those districts. Who's being targeted and why?
Well, a lot of them, Jennifer, are just by virtue of the fact that they're traditional swing districts. Take, say, Amy Volk's district in Scarborough. That's usually a swing district. I mean, it's gone from Democrat to Republican, from, you know, and bouncing back and forth over the last 10, maybe even 10 years or longer. And so that's one of the more targeted races by these groups that can spend unlimited amount of money to influence the outcomes. And we're already seeing that. I mean, that is a heavily targeted race. The race in Belfast and Winthrop in that area, which is Senate District 11, which is the seat currently held by the current Senate President Mike Thibodeau, that's a heavily targeted race. There's a race, Senate District 14, which is, I think, Manchester, Winthrop, Reedfield. Mm-hmm. That's another heavily targeted race. All of those are by virtue of the fact that they swing all the time. That's why we call them swing districts. So that's one reason. And you can see that in the Senate, especially just because there are bigger districts, there's more money going in there. It's a lot, as Mal will probably tell you, it's a lot harder to see that how that shakes out in the House just by virtue of the fact there's so many districts.
Yeah, you got to remember in the House of Representatives, Jen, you're only representing 9,000 plus people, which means the old-fashioned going door-to-door and asking for a vote is still the principal way that people campaign. Money does play a role, of course. There's direct mail and that sort of thing. But you don't get into the television ads and radio ads and social media campaigns you see in the state Senate races. And Steve was talking about some of the dark money coming in. And then there's the not-so-dark money, but still money being spent to influence a race from so-called leadership PACs. Mm-hmm. Those are people who want to move up in leadership, so they go out and raise money for those PACs and then spend money on behalf of a candidate, maybe a candidate that's running as part of the publicly financed clean election system that can't go any further, but this independent group can now spend money in that race. So we're going to see a lot of money spent on legislative races for the reasons we've discussed, and the fact that we have so many races in play.
Yeah, I think, Jen, just to jump in, we've already seen, it may have actually gone over this threshold already, $4 million in outside money coming in. Now, the majority of that money is going to influence the gubernatorial contest, but there's already a lot that is going into these legislative races. Some of them swing, some of them on the margins. And I think, you know, to Mal's point about leadership, one of the ideas behind leadership PACs is that people who want to become, say, Speaker of the House or Senate President or something else, they form these PACs basically to go out and help other candidates. And if they are successful, that will help them in their quest to become leaders of the House and or the Senate.
And Steve, why are we seeing this year?
Well, I think part of it is what I just mentioned at the top, which is that we've got the census is coming up in 2020, and that means we're going to see new congressional maps being drawn, in Maine's case, one of 34 states, by the state legislature. And so who has control in the legislature is going to have a bigger say in how those maps are drawn. And so that will make a bit, and that in turn makes a big difference in how we are represented in Congress between the two districts, congressional districts that we have. That's one reason. Another reason is that in the past, Republicans have really had a stranglehold on state houses and governorships. I think they control, last count, 62% of legislative chambers in this country. And Democrats only control 15 governorships, which is the fewest since 1922. What you're seeing this year are outside groups that are progressive, dear towards electing progressive candidates, are trying to break that grip. They understand that state legislatures are an important place for formulating policy, especially with gridlock in Congress. That's why they're focusing on state houses to do this. And so that's a big reason for that money coming in. Now, there are other consequences for that money coming in, which is that the people that are elected by virtue of that money may feel beholden to the interests of those interest groups and not necessarily the interests of Mainers.
And some of those amounts of money could get huge because of this. Now, we've always had the Republicans, at least for like 10 years, really focused on legislative races. They have spent money from the national level with special committees aimed at the legislature. Now the Democrats are doing the same thing through these independent groups. And we're starting to see amounts of money being spent in legislative races that, well, some of us anyway, could remember used to be what you needed to run for Congress in this state.
That's right.
And now you're seeing that kind of money being spent in a state Senate race.
Yeah, to Mal's point, I mean, go back to 2010. And there was a big deal made in 2010 because the Republican State Leadership Committee, which is part of this arm of the GOP that tries to elect Republicans in state legislatures. They're active all over the country. Now, they came in really late in 2010 and dropped really, really negative flyers. And I think it was like a handful, maybe six races, legislative races, maybe more than that. And that was considered a huge amount of money. That's nothing now. I mean, I remember it was like $400,000 at the time. We're way past that. And that just goes to illustrate the stakes that have been raised at having power in the state legislatures. Democrats are behind in that game. They're trying to catch up this year.
We're going to go to the calls now. We're going to go to Kent Ackley, who's calling in. Kent, you're the representative from Monmouth.
Hey, good afternoon, Jennifer. It's Kent. How are you?
I'm great. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I simply wanted to point out that as voters go to the booths to cast their votes on November 6th, that there are actually a near record all-time high number of independent candidates that are running for legislature this year.
And Kent, are you one of them?
Oh, yes. I'm the serving as a representative for Monmouth and up for re-election, but there are well over 20 statewide that will be on the ballot in various House of Representatives seats and senatorial seats.
Kent, what would it mean for you in a practical way to have more independent legislators with you in Augusta?
Well, it means that there's less influence from the two major parties and that folks can have a reasonable conversation about getting things done rather than just bickering and posturing.
Steve, Mal, thoughts on the number of independent candidates running this year?
Well, I think Kent, he did a good job of advocating for himself on that call and also for the other independents that are running. It's true that there has been more independents or unenrolled candidates. He's absolutely correct about that. But we've also had a lot of independent candidates in the past. I mean, Maine's their electorate is, majority of the people are unenrolled. They're independent by, ostensibly.
The reality, though, is that independents kind of have a built-in disadvantage because they don't have these big party money machines bringing money in to try to support them. So they have to do it the old-fashioned way, and I mentioned a few minutes ago, and that's going door-to-door, which can be done and is often done in House districts because, as I said, you're only representing 9,000 people. You literally can meet every one of them.
Yeah, that's right. I think Mal's point is really important, is that I think independents really do have a harder time because they don't have the political machine behind them. I think they're trying to change that. I think they are trying to be as organized as, say, an affiliated party, while balancing the fact that unaffiliated candidates have a diverse cross-section of views. You know, I'm sure that, say, Kent Ackley doesn't have the same views as Dick Woodbury did when he was in the state Senate.
Kent, thanks so much for calling in and joining in the conversation. You are listening to a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. My guests this half hour are Maine Public political reporters Steve Missler and Mal Leary, and we are discussing the election, money, and the state legislature. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Mal, are we seeing any polling on these races? Do we have any idea what the legislature is going to look like come January?
This is one of those strange situations where I could tell you there's a ton of polling going on by the parties.
That's right.
And they sometimes will tell you what they're seeing, and sometimes they won't. But as for public polling, no. As you're aware, we have very few public polls for governor, Senate, and Congress, let alone down into the legislative races. But talking to both sides of the aisle, for example, the state Senate has 35 seats. And right now it looks like 6 or 7 are toss-ups. And that will determine who controls the state Senate. Steve talked about Amy Volk's seat. That's one of them. There are several spread across the state. So we could conceivably have someone, one of the parties, have a strong majority. Or we could be back to 1817.
Right.
It depends on how those swing districts end up when the votes are finally counted.
Yeah, and that dynamic is going to be really important in terms of what we might see in the next legislature in terms of bills and whether or not those bills would even have a chance. It's also going to be a huge factor in determining how the next governor is able to, what that person is able to put forward for policies. I mean, let's say Sean Moody gets elected governor and he's the Republican candidate. And you'll be able to talk to him about this after we're done. But if he gets in and all of a sudden he's confronted with the fact that, say, Democrats have a super majority in the legislature, well, he's not going to have a lot. He's not going to be able to push his policies as much. He's going to have to actually talk to those people, the Democratic majorities, to get something done. Well, what if Democrats have just a slim majority in the legislature? Well, that's going to mean that Republicans, probably in the House, will have a much similar dynamic that we have right now with Governor LePage and the split upstairs, which is that there a handful of Republicans in the House could help bolster Moody's policy agenda by virtue of, you know, helping him sustain vetoes, or they could just block Democrats' policies.
Were you going to say the same goes if Janet Mills or Terry Hayes is elected?
Yeah, exactly. Or Alan Karen. Same thing. Yep, same thing. Exactly.
We're going to go to Diane calling from Shabig Island. Hi, Diane. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm curious about the influence that ALEC retains on the legislature. I know Senator Michaud was a member, might be a current member of ALEC, but just going forward, I was wondering who might also be a member.
I'm not sure that that's accurate. I don't recall him being a member of ALEC when he served in the legislature. But there are people that have been prominent in ALEC. Senator Andre Cushing mm-hmm. comes to mind, who just left office this term. ALEC is a group that sets policy together that they try to adopt in states across the country. They're not the only ones that do that. They're more prominent because they've been around longer, and they try to set a lot of policies covering a lot of areas, as opposed, for example, to a group like the National Resources Defense Fund, which is narrowly focused and are trying to pass strong environmental laws at each state, and they will come up with model statutes and try to push them state by state. So it's a phenomenon based on trying to get your policy through at the state level because you haven't been able to get it through at the federal level.
Yeah, and this also comes back to the point I was making earlier where Republicans and conservatives are much further ahead in this game than Democrats. ALEC is known by people because they've been successful in getting model legislation pushed through state legislatures in Maine and other states. Democrats haven't had that. They've had attempts at that. They're trying to get footing on a similar level through a variety of groups, some of which the name escapes me right now, but there's at least one other that's competing. It's trying to level the playing field with ALEC. And so there are Democrats that are pushing model legislation as well. It's a little bit different in terms of the interest groups that are pushing that. On ALEC's side, a lot of times it's corporations.
Diane, thanks so much for your call. And we're going to move to Lincolnville and Christine. Hi, Christine. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. The point that I was hoping to make, I was a representative in the State House from 14 to 16. And I know there's a gentleman, I don't know the number of the race, but he ran traditionally versus the woman who was a representative prior to, who ran as a clean election candidate. And he had sunk something like 45, and I may be off on these numbers, I've heard between $45,000 and $60,000 of his own money in versus a clean election candidate who has only like $8,000 to work on. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could speak to that.
Sure, I'll jump in. That is a dynamic that plays out all across the state. That's true. But that's also another reason why there are leadership PACs and party committees that will go in and try to help, say, a clean elections candidate or a publicly financed candidate level the playing field against somebody who's raised a lot of money. That's one of the functions of those outside groups.
And this is a function of Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, which says if you are a rich individual and you're running for the legislature, you can spend as much money to support yourself as you want. So you could also set up a PAC that could support your friend who's running two districts over. So, I mean, that has undercut the clean election system pretty dramatically. It used to be a pretty level playing field between traditionally funded and the clean election system. But once that court case has come down, even though they've tried to tweak it so that you can get some extra money by getting more $5 contributions, it never gets to the point where it's really equivalent to what can be spent independently under Citizens United.
Yeah, there's a real calculation by candidates about whether they want to run clean elections. I can think of, I think it was 2012 races where Dick Woodbury was running for what was a toss-up seat in the Yarmouth area, and there was tons of outside money coming from conservative groups, and he was running clean. And so there was some question about whether he would survive that race, even though he's very popular in that area, because he didn't have the resources to fight back because he was running as a clean elections candidate, and they were piling on against him with conservative outside groups that can spend unlimited amounts of money.
Christine, thank you. Good question. We have Andrea on Facebook asking, we can all decry the influence of money on these races, but isn't the media also at fault for assessing the candidates based on their money raising? It's very hard to find in-depth reporting on a legislator's voting record and or more nuanced performance in office, including behind closed doors. How do we make informed decisions?
Well, I guess it's on us, Mal.
Well, I mean, the reality is there just is not the amount of reporters to look at every one of these legislative races and do the sort of compare and contrast on issues. I mean, some of the local newspapers, the weeklies, try to do a good job putting out questionnaires and showing where people stand. But, you know, the reality is Steve and I are focused on the top of the ticket. Mm-hmm. The top races where we do our best to try to compare and contrast and let people know where the candidates stand on the issues. It's really difficult when you start getting down into House District 4.
Right. There's 181 seats. It's hard you know, you would like to think that local newspapers are doing that for the people who are running in their areas. But, you know, the local press is vastly depleted, not just at the State House, but at in every town and community across the state.
I just have about a minute left with you guys, and I want to ask you, a lot of attention has been placed on how much the congressional races throughout the country are really often seen as really being about President Trump. How much of an influence does the presidency have on the legislative races in Maine?
I don't think it has a lot of impact on legislative races. I think it is correct that it does have on congressional, because members of Congress will work with the president. Legislative races, when we're talking, as we've been talking about, Jennifer, a House seat, I mean, oftentimes people know everybody. Quick digression here to show you how strange things can be. It was a strongly Republican district in which a Democrat won, and I couldn't figure out, how did this person win? Well, I called somebody who had been in the legislature I knew and said, what happened there? Oh, he was having an affair, and everybody in town knew it, so that's why he got defeated.
Yeah, I guess the answer there is that everything is very local on the legislative side, especially those House races. I mean, you're talking about 6,000 people so in a district. So that's, you know, if everybody knows everybody, that can be the thing that determines tips a race rather than, say, whether or not they support the policies of President Trump.
Well, thank you both of you for taking time out of your day and joining us here on Maine Calling. That was Steve Missler and Mal Leary. They're the political reporters with Maine Public Radio, and very busy this season. John Keimel ran the board for this half hour. We had additional help from John Bradford. You can find all of our Your Vote 2018 interviews, as well as more information on the candidates and their positions, on the Maine Public website that is constantly being updated. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. When we come back, gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody joins me. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling.
Drinking water around the country is polluted with a potentially harmful group of chemicals linked to a wide range of illnesses.
Cancer, low birth weight, thyroid disease, elevated cholesterol, and effects on the immune system.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Where these chemicals come from and how they might be regulated, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. This Wednesday afternoon at 2:20, the Federal Emergency Management Agency will issue a nationwide test of the emergency alert system and wireless emergency alerts to test national warning capabilities. The test message will also be sent throughout the nation to all radio, TV, and compatible cell phones. You may be surprised if your cell phone receives an alert about 2:18 this Wednesday afternoon, while the broadcast EAS test alert will take place at 2:20. The test will assess the operational readiness of the infrastructure for national alerts. Maine Public, with our statewide radio and television infrastructure, distributes the signal to all Maine broadcasters. Again, this test takes place Wednesday afternoon at 2:18 for cell phones and 2:20 for broadcasters.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lewis, author of the best-selling books The Big Short and Moneyball, talks about his new book, The Fifth Risk. It looks at the federal government under President Trump by focusing on Trump's departments of energy, agriculture, and commerce, and how unprepared they are now to deal with urgent risks. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Later today, during All Things Considered here on Maine Public Radio, we'll have the first report in our series on the future of seafood farming in Maine, Aquaculture's Next Wave, with a look at how scallop fishing is growing in Maine thanks to new practices and technology imported from Japan. That's later today on All Things Considered. A brief look at the weather. More heavy rain is on its way, with it later today could be a thunderstorm for southern locations and some rain for far northern Maine as well. Temperatures will stay in the 50s. Tonight, the rain will begin to taper off, though an overnight thunderstorm will still be possible in the south. Lows from 40 to 50 degrees. Skies will clear tomorrow, especially over southern Maine, mid-50s north, mid-60s south. Thursday will be warmer, many places getting back into the 70s. You make Your Vote 2018 programming possible, as do AARP Maine. advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families, and reminding you to be the difference this November and vote. Lambert Coffin, advocating for individuals and businesses in Maine trial courts and administrative agencies, online at lambertcoffin.com. And MEMIC, celebrating 25 years of working with employers and employees to reduce workplace injuries, on the web at MEMIC.com.
From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. My guest this half hour is Sean Moody, the Republican candidate for governor. What questions do you have for him? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief, please brief, email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Sean Moody, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Hey, Jennifer. I'm a little disappointed, though, I'm not in studio with you. I'm up here, obviously, with Mal. Not that I'm disappointed to be with Mal. Take it that way. But I'm sorry I can't be there with you live in Portland.
Well, I'm glad you're here on a Maine Public mic. So our first question for you, what, if anything, should be done about the partisan divide in our state?
Well, I think that's probably the number one issue that's on most people's minds. What I think's happened, Jennifer, is if you look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now with the partisan politics there, it's just transcended down into our home state of Maine. And one of the root causes of this, I believe, is the citizens' referendum process. Now, we've got three equal branches of government. The legislative branch is very important to make laws, have a public hearing process, they vet these things, make sure they're constitutional. And the citizens' referendum has basically bypassed the legislature. So I believe the citizens' referendum process was put in place to keep the legislature in check, not to replace the legislature. So I believe we need citizen reform, a citizens' referendum reform that would give a better representation of the rural areas of our state and make sure that these really difficult, contentious laws, basically is what they are, properly vetted, have the public hearings that they are warranted, have an economic study in terms of the tax impacts, and make sure they're constitutional. Sean, so I think, you know, Jennifer, there's an old saying, you make your bed, you lay in it. I think the legislature is laying in a bed they didn't make, and it's creating a lot of dissension, a lot of contention.
Sean, do you support the plan to expand Medicaid? If not, what would you put in its place? If so, how would you pay for it?
That's a great question. I know it's on a lot of Mainers' minds. There's a lot of folks that are currently covered under Medicaid. And my view is this, you know, as your next governor, I'm going to be swearing an oath in office to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state of Maine. Medicaid expansion is a law. That's been settled. Now we have to find a way to get the legislature together. I recently met with the CEOs of the major hospitals in the state, and they agreed to come to the table to discuss how we're going to fund this responsibly and sustainably. That's going to be a top priority.
What would you do to address Maine's workforce shortage?
Well, this is where I think you can draw a real contrast between myself and the other candidates. I have 40 years of executive experience in the private sector, growing a best-in-class business right here in the state of Maine. So we started creating a workforce development program called Grow Our Own 15 years ago, because we knew the biggest challenge to growing our company was going to be hiring skilled and trained people. And two things, Jennifer, I would bring as the next governor. Number one, we've got to reform our vocational and career tech ed programs here in the state. We've really, I think, turned our back on the blue-collar trades in the state, and these are great-paying jobs. You can't find an electrician, a plumber, a carpenter, a machinist, a welder. And these jobs, Jennifer, pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, and you can get through programs, training programs, with little or no student debt. So I really want to have the best trade schools in the country. And being a blue-collar guy, a master craftsman myself, that's a unique perspective that none of the other candidates have. The other important issue in terms of workforce is we need to go out and recruit our former Mainers that left in search of opportunity. 7 or 8 years ago, when the economy, we had literally double-digit unemployment here in the state. Now we're at full employment. So we'll create a strategic marketing plan to go out and recruit former Mainers that have left the state and incentivize them to bring their families, bring their talent, bring their capital back to Maine and invest. Another avenue of increasing our young, healthy population is we have 30 million tourists that come and enjoy a beautiful state here with us in Maine. If we could just hang on to 1% of those 30 million tourists, that's 30,000 individuals that love our state. That's why they come here. And again, we're looking for young, healthy, talented individuals that want to stay here and raise their families. The last component we need for workforce is our immigrant population. We need to make sure that our immigrants have a pathway to employment. I think the bureaucracy, federal government and state, sometimes get in the way of somebody being able to be gainfully employed. So I would make sure we have career counselors and people that, interpreters that know the language, so we can determine where these folks came from, their home country. What did they do? They had an occupation. You know, were they a teacher or a nurse? Perhaps they were a welder. So we can align these individuals with the jobs that we have in their respective area. And that also is going to take pressure off housing. It's going to take pressure off general assistance. And it's going to fill our employment needs right now.
Sean, as governor, what would you do to address Maine's opioid crisis?
Well, that's a really emotional subject and topic. I mean, that grips every family, every community in the state. And I think we need a multifaceted approach. Enforcement has got to be resourced in a way to combat criminal organizations. This isn't happenstance. You know, people aren't selling drugs on the side to pay for their habits. These are criminal organizations that come into our state targeting our most vulnerable. The second thing that we've got to really focus on is our treatment. I've spent a lot of extensive time in our recovery community, places like ENSO, which is a private recovery center, Milestone Recovery, the Macaulay House, that's through Mercy, and Maine Med has a recovery center in Biddeford. So I've really done some deep research, and I feel that our recovery community has got to have, and they've agreed they would do it, a matrix of not less than 5 and not more than 10 outcomes that they want to generate as part of their work. So how many people they have in treatment, how many people are on a path to sobriety, how many people have relapsed. So we can share these best practices across the state recovery units so that we can scale them up and really get the value, the programs that are really working well, and we're going to have to eliminate the programs that aren't working at all.
Sean, as you may imagine,
The final component is education. And I would make sure, having talked to a lot of people that are in recovery, it's twofold. This is so critical, Jennifer. We need to get these former, substance use disorder patients that are in recovery into our middle schools, younger age in schools, and tell the students their story. They're so compelling what happened in their lives. They have a relatively normal life, family, job, and it all unraveled within a 5 or 6 month period. They lost everything, ended up homeless. And I think when the students hear what an incredible experience to get on a pathway of sobriety and get their life back together, that's going to make it a marked impression on these young students to keep them out of the dangers of substance use disorder.
As you may know, we have been asking members of the public to send in questions on a voicemail box, and we're going to go to one of those questions right now.
Hi, my name is Barbara, and I'm calling from Brooksville. I am wondering what any of the candidates are planning to do to help retain young Mainers to stay in Maine and work, and also what their plans are to help expand internet in small remote areas that really depend on it, that they can't get it because it's so remote, and how they're hoping to do that. Thank you.
Barbara, that's a couple of great questions. The first one I alluded to earlier on workforce development. This is just the fact, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it, but it's the truth. 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago, was everybody's got to go to college and get a degree if they're going to amount to anything, if they're going to pursue a viable career. And the reality is that's simply not the case. And some of these young, most talented, gifted young adults that we have currently in our school systems, 40 or 45% of them are not going on to college. So we've got to teach them, give them the skills, teach them a trade so they can go out and make a great living. The other component, and I've been on the university system and the community college boards of trustees, and we've done great work, get to those two systems to collaborate together. Now you can transfer credits from the community college system to the university system. It saves a tremendous amount of money. So I think keeping college costs affordable here in the state of Maine and introducing and changing the message of people that say, hey, there's no opportunity here in Maine. There's never been a time in the state's history for more upward mobility than right now. We need to broadcast that message across our school systems, our guidance counselors, and our parents.
We have an email from Robin. Sean Moody stated at a gubernatorial debate back in January and was quoted as saying that schools are overfunded. Meanwhile, it's been reported on Maine Public Radio and the Bangor Daily News that many school districts are having to defer maintenance of their old and crumbling buildings because towns can't afford it. We also know many teachers are buying school supplies out of their own pockets so that students have the things they need to succeed in the classroom. Also, our funding formula was looked at a company at the behest of Paul LePage. The conclusion was that although the formula is fair, schools are seriously underfunded. Can he explain why he thinks schools are overfunded?
Well, Jennifer, I was hoping you were going to say that the Bangor Daily News Maine Public did that the actual what I said. They just took one snippet, the first word that I said, and they didn't let me finish my sentence, which is obviously documented. And I said, we need to make sure that, overfunded, schools need to be more efficient and more effective. And so what I meant by that was, and I'm so glad she asked that question, not many people know my education background. I spent 4 years on the university system, the community college boards of trustees. I've traveled the entire state from Fort Kent to York County Community College. And this is a volunteer position. Okay, look at USM where it was 4 years ago, and look where USM is today. And I talked about the credit transfers and what we've been able to do across these two systems. So I obviously take great odds about that attack ad because of my commitment to higher education here in the state. And also, I've served on a school business roundtable in the town of Gorham for the last 6 years. And we've reintroduced the co-op program where young students like myself could get out of school early and actually go to work and get credit for it. Now we're a part of the Jobs for Maine Graduates program, down there. So I have invested 6 or 7 years of my life in education from high school right up through higher ed and had extraordinary success in doing so. We removed $80 million of back office and administrative overhead on the university system side. That's recurring, not one time. That's exactly what I meant, Jennifer, when I said we need to go in to our K-12 educational system and take a hard look at the administrative overhead and duplication that we have of services that we don't need and have no impact on that teacher that's not getting paid enough in the classroom. There's no way that we should be spending a couple billion dollars on education and have educators, teachers buying classroom supplies. That's an operational problem. That's not a funding problem. That's what we call priorities. And I am adamant that we will do what we did in the university and community college system in collaboration, the same thing with K-12.
So to be clear, you believe that those savings will be enough and that there is no additional funding needed for Maine's K-12 schools?
Well, they just got, they just got $162 million in additional funding. So I was taking that into account in the response to that question. They just received $162 million in additional funding, and I haven't heard, and I never saw a comprehensive plan of where those dollars were going to go. Were they going to hit rural school districts that are in dire need, like you said, for facilities upkeep and teacher salaries, or are they going to be more in the affluent school systems where, arguably, they have the resources they already need? So I am very focused on K-12 education reform so we can listen to the teachers, what they need in the classroom, and not necessarily, it's like Horton Hears a Who, from the higher ups that are, they're the ones that are kind of making the decisions, and the teachers are getting tired of the bureaucracy. They don't have time to teach in the classroom anymore. Then I will just add this. Our organization has been named the best places to work in Maine. So we know how to run an organization. A third of our company is owned by our coworkers. We've created a culture of high performance And that's exactly what we need in a K-12 education system, because the morale there is terrible. I know there was a survey done by the MEA. They asked tenured teachers what they would, if they would recommend teaching as a profession. Only 13% of the teachers said that they would recommend teaching as a profession. That education, K-12, is in crisis, and I'm going to come to the rescue.
You're listening to a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and my guest this half hour is Sean Moody, Republican candidate for governor. We're going to go to another one of those voicemail questions.
Hello, my name is Devin. I'm from Camden. I have a question for Sean Moody. Since no two people are identical and no two governors govern identically, what are the important points of difference between you and Governor LePage?
Well, Devin, that's a great question. My mom was a single mom, and she raised the three of us. And one thing she instilled in us, and my wife Christy and I abided by raising four of our own children, is not to do comparisons, you know, like, oh, your brother's a better student or your sister's a better athlete. But I will say this about myself individually. I've been in private sector for 40 years, and we started the Gorham Times in our community, the local community newspaper. I served on the transportation committee and bypass committee in our hometown of Gorham so we could get the bypass out around the village. The comprehensive plan committee resulted in our downtown village being intact, unlike, you know, Windham and Scarborough. I've served on the university system, community college boards. That's $750 million budget between those two. And nobody had the vision. I mean, there's a lot of people passionate about education in the state, but it took me, as somebody from the outside with a fresh set of eyes, to recognize that those two systems were siloed. They were competing for funding. They were competing for students. They were not collaborating. You couldn't even transfer credits across the system. So if you look at where that system was 4 years ago, and the work that we did, and I'm not taking the credits, the boards, you know, the faculty, the president and the chancellor. Now, those two systems are working at a level of collaboration never seen before. And so I am a collaborator. I believe in empowering people, like we've done it in our private enterprise, with 34% of the companies owned by the coworkers. We give 10% of our after-tax profit back to our coworkers in the form of profit sharing, and they have full transparency, open book management. So they see our revenue, our profit, our key performance indicators, our customer satisfaction, our receivables. That's exactly how we're going to run the state. We're going to have, it's not going to be an us versus them culture. It's going to be, look, this is our state. We're all in this together. Build some consensus. And let's move the state forward.
We'll go to Carl, who's calling from Green. Hi, Carl. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with Sean Moody.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for this forum. My question is related to housing. If we look around, Maine has some of the oldest housing stock in the country, coupled with brutally cold winters and an aging population. Mainers, whether we've come here for a way or been born here, have worked hard to create communities and homes and lives. So my question is, what's your plan to ensure that Mainers can remain in their houses by retrofitting them and allowing for aging in place and to have affordable, accessible housing?
Well, that's a great question, Carl. I believe the same thing that's happened in Maine over the last 8 years is, again, messaging. We're telling all these young people there's no opportunity here. So our healthiest, most talented, most productive segment of our population has left. And you're right. Things are just, you know, kind of deteriorating here. It's been a tough economy. We're finally, now our economy's back on track. It's growing. So we need to get these young former Mainers, incentivize them through tuition reimbursement, student loan forgiveness, to come back into the local communities. And I am really bullish on Maine right now, because you can buy real estate in Maine at a really discounted price in comparison to states like Massachusetts or Connecticut. And we can hook up broadband internet service into our rural communities and put them into like cloud spaces. So the lady, I'm sorry I didn't get to that lady's question prior, but what's what she was saying? How are you going to get the fiber run into all the areas of Maine? It's so expensive. But we have dedicated cloud spaces, whether it's libraries, university space. So people, entrepreneurs, small business owners can congregate there. And it's not always just about broadband. It's also about bandwidth, you know, enough to run a high performance or robust management system, whatever. So the housing stock in Maine, You've seen it in areas like Millinocket. You've seen it in areas Dover, Foxcroft. Money is, and Monson's a good example. Money is starting to flow back into the state. People are making more money. The economy is doing better. And I think we're right on that turn where the time to buy is at the bottom in terms of real estate in our rural areas. And I really see a migration into these areas.
How about Carl's broader question, though, about how to help older people stay in their homes?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Again, if you're reuniting our families, this is a big picture. Reuniting our families by bringing the former sons, daughters, granddaughters, and grandsons back to the local areas and communities, they will take care of their families. And I think that's an important component that we've lost here in the state of Maine over the last, 7 or 8 years. We have to reverse that trend because nobody knows how to take care of a family member better than them. And I think the other thing that's important, Jennifer, go back to your school question. If we don't restructure K-12 education and reform it in a way that has a much more efficient delivery model, more cost-effective delivery model, our elder population is going to be forced out of their homes because of the increases in property taxes.
Carl, thanks so much for your question. Bob on Facebook asks, what is your position on solar energy in Maine? If the legislature passes solar bills, like the two bills in the last session that the Governor LePage vetoed, will you do the same? If not, what's your perspective on solar energy?
Well, that's a great observation. Renewable energy, the first thing I would do is create a widespread, overarching energy policy. Right now, the state doesn't have one. We need an energy policy that puts renewables on a level playing field with the rest of our energy providers. That's the first thing that we do. In terms of specifically solar, our company has a solar array system, a renewable energy project based right now at the Maine Audubon campus in Falmouth. I think at the time it might have been the biggest public-private partnership in the state back then. I know Senator King was there, cut the ribbon or whatever. So we're very familiar with solar energy, renewable energy. Here in the state of Maine, it's an emerging industry. Phil Koop is a good friend. I actually spoke at Revision Energy's annual company banquet here about 3 months ago. They're an ESOP company, an employee-owned company like Moody's. So we are in the renewable energy business right now, and obviously we're a big advocate of renewables. We just got to make sure that they're all on a level and fair playing field. I think that's what they expect. And that's what we're going to provide.
We're going to go to another of those questions that came in on our voice mailbox, Sean.
Hi, my name is Patrice, and I'm calling from Bowdoin. And I'd like to ask John Moody why he isn't releasing his income taxes. Thank you.
That's a great question. It's not required. It's not a requirement for the state, whatever, for this position, but we did fill out the forms that would be required and submitted those. But here's the most important thing, and I hope that people out there can really appreciate my response. You heard me talk about Moody's being employee-owned. Well, in an S corporation, the business taxes, the business income, and confidential information on the tax return flows through to my wife and I's personal tax return. So if Chrissy and I release our personal tax return, it's got Moody's company information, revenue, profit embedded in that tax return. So that I'm a fiduciary, and that would put us at a company at a competitive disadvantage. So there's nobody that would take their business tax return and make it public, a privately held company and owned by our employees, and it would be compromising our business integrity.
We'll go to Ann, who's calling from Waldo. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. You're speaking with Sean Moody.
Thank you, Jennifer. I just have just one quick statement. It would be something for you to look at about the numbers of schools that are putting in food pantries, because that has risen in the last several years. I know for sure. I worked in a school system, and they did put in a food pantry for their high-poverty children. Maine has the distinction of a rise in infant mortality. And as a former nurse, I know I was very concerned during the LePage administration. One half of all visiting nurses were cut under Governor LePage. And I just wonder what your thoughts were about reinstating those positions.
Yeah, this is something I'm obviously very, very concerned about. We're at almost virtually full employment here in this state, and the increasing demand on our food pantries. My wife, Chrissy, is actually on the Gorham Food Pantry board, and she's been on that board for a lot of years. And so I need to do a deeper dive into better understanding why, you know, our food pantries are coming in more demand, and the opiate crisis is flaring up. It goes counter to what you would think with a robust economy and full employment. So I believe, and this is anecdotal, okay, but I believe that those young men and women, mostly men that I was talking about, that didn't get the skills or the training they need to go out into the trades and earn a good living, there's about 10 or 15,000 of them in Maine right now that are just off the radar. They're not employed, but they're not on assistance. We don't know what they're doing. And I think that's what's creating a lot of our social service problems and cost. And the other thing that's important to note is I will commit to reforming our mental health system here in the state of Maine. You know, my mom struggled with mental health, and I became her legal medical guardian in 1994. And I'll tell you, that changed our family's life, the quality of our lives. And Mom lived to be 83, and she passed away a couple years ago. But by me being able to go to her doctor's appointments and make sure that she's on the right regimen, you know, she was stable, and she lived a good quality life. So these are the root causes of what's happening in our society today. We're not addressing the stigma associated with mental health, which I will pledge to do. I promise to do that. It's personal to me. And we also have to look at giving people the skills and the training they need to go out and live a very productive life and take care of their families, not scrape by $10 an hour or working under the table and good enough, getting into drugs. And the mental health scenario oftentimes leads itself to drug use because people try to self-medicate. So these are all complex socioeconomic problems that I'm going to tackle.
Sean Moody, thank you so much for joining us here on Maine Calling. Sean Moody, the Republican candidate for governor. John Keimel ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford. All of our Your Vote 2018 interviews are being updated on the Maine Public website. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling.